Okay, it's 2 o'clock. Let's get going. This is to make sure everybody's in the right place. This is session 343, pursuing truth through fiction, the assassination of Governor Boggs, a historical novel by Rod Miller. That's a good idea. And Rod Miller in the cowboy hat is a Utah author, originally from Utah. And he has both fiction and nonfiction books and poetry books, and your program gives the titles of some of his books. Today is here to talk about his book, The Assassination of Governor Boggs, which is his second novel and sixth book. He also writes essays, short stories, and magazine articles. And as someone who is a journalist from way back, I am very impressed with this. He also is a member and sits on the executive board of the Western Writers of America. So I'd like to welcome him today, and we will have time for questions and answers at the end.
Thank you, Louise. I'm glad that we're all here. I'm glad I'm here, but I'm even gladder that you're here. I won't spend any more time in introductions or anything. We'll just dive right into this. And as Louise says, there will be plenty of time afterwards for questions. So if there's any curiosity or anything you have, there will be plenty of time to talk about it. The title of the talk, as you know, is Pursuing Truth Through Fiction, The Assassination of Governor Boggs, which is the title of my latest book, published just a month or two ago by Cedar Fort down in Springville under the Bonneville Books imprint, and it's stocked in a lot of bookstores and available by special order anywhere. It's also on Amazon in a Kindle edition as well as paperback, so shouldn't be too hard to find if you're interested, and I hope you are. There's a long history of using fiction in the search for truth, and the New Testament, this being a religiously oriented symposium. I'll use the New Testament as an example, where Jesus often used parables, which are fiction, to help others realize truth. Fiction allows a storyteller or truth seeker to manipulate people and events for dramatic effect, to pile on layers of meaning, to heighten emotion and add emphasis. But the storyteller tells stories in ways that force listeners to arrive at their own conclusions, to realize their own truths. It is a poor story that does all the work for the listener, that does not require the participation of the audience, that does all the thinking. Consider the parables of Jesus Christ. Seldom, if ever, did he give a straight answer when questioned. Oftentimes he would tell a story, a parable, that captured the essence of the question in a dramatic situation rich with conflict and layered with meaning, which ended with a question, sometimes implied, that required the audience to provide the answer, often at the expense of their preconceived notions. Good stories are not sermons. They are not morality plays or pageants. They do not take listeners by the hands and lead them to a prearranged or foreordained or inevitable conclusion. Good stories are more often challenging and uncomfortable than warm and satisfying. And while they may be edifying, they are not always soothing. Jesus seemed to delight in making people squirm, in forcing them into difficult and challenging, and sometimes unaccustomed places, where they were obliged to cast aside the conventional wisdom, the received knowledge, and speak for or think for themselves. Now, just so you don't get me wrong here, the assassination of Governor Boggs is in no way comparable to the parables of Jesus Christ. In fact, it's not even comparable to libraries that are full of many better stories. But it does, in its own way, attempt to pursue truth through fiction. It is a particular kind of fiction, historical fiction, that uses actual events, people, and places from history mixed with the inventions of the author. It usually attempts to remain true to the facts and to the known, but can be equally true to the dramatic, the unknown, and the speculative. Being fiction, the title of the book itself is contrary to one essential fact. Governor Boggs was not assassinated. And if you want to pick nits, he was no longer the governor. But such honorifics are often carried for life, so I don't worry much about that. The assassination is part of a bit of literary license that comes from the newspapers of the day, which widely reported an assassination, such as this headline and lead from an account in the May 21st, 1842 Quincy Whig. You'll notice the text of that report says, Lilburn W. Boggs, late governor of Missouri, was assassinated at his residence in Independence, Missouri, by an unknown hand on the 6th instant. His assassination was widely reported, and it took some time to set the record straight. But it is the phrase in that news story, by an unknown hand, that is the basis for this book, The Assassination of Governor Boggs. The history on which the book is based involves two principal figures all of you are probably familiar with, Porter Rockwell and Lilburn Boggs. I confess to being a big fan of Warren Porter Rockwell. He was a man unmatched on the Western frontier. His skill with livestock was the stuff of legends. He could ride or drive horses faster and farther without ill effect than most. He was a horse trainer of renown. His tracking skills were legendary and in much demand, and he was famous for recovering rustled livestock and fleeing outlaws. He was a sought-after scout and hunter, a skilled freighter and a speedy courier. He was an officer of the law and a deputy United States Marshal who, more often than not, got his man. But besides being a lawman, Rockwell was, at times, an outlaw. Like many legendary figures of the Old West, Wyatt Earp, Henry Plummer, and Tom Horn being a few notable examples, Porter Rockwell walked on both sides of the fuzzy line that marked frontier law as occasion and circumstance demanded. He was a cold-blooded killer, facing down and besting enough men to rank him among the fiercest gunfighters in the Old West. Some were righteous killings, some were questionable, and some were certainly crimes. On the day he died, with his boots on, I might add, he was awaiting trial for murder and may well have been convicted. Lilburn Boggs is famous in Mormondom. I should mention that neither Rockwell nor Boggs were this short or this fat. For some reason, the screen is expanding things. So he's a much slender fellow. Boggs is famous in Mormondom as the author of the infamous extermination order that expelled the Mormons from Missouri under threat of death. Most Mormons know nothing else about him, nor do they care to. They are content to have a cardboard cutout for an enemy. But there was more to the man. As I have his son Bill Boggs say in the book, folks who did not know my father may think him a pale-faced, soft-bellied man who was most at home with his knees under a desk. No, not the governor. He was a frontiersman, hard as flint and tougher than rawhide. And while those words are mine, they are true and may well have been used by contemporaries to describe the governor. Boggs was a frontiersman long before Rockwell. He came early to western Missouri, which was beyond the frontier at the time, and was a Santa Fe trader. He married into the Bent family, son-in-law of Silas Bent and brother-in-law of Charles and William Bent, and played a role in their far-flung fern trading empire. When that woman died, he married a granddaughter of Daniel Boone. He emigrated early on to the far west, a full year ahead of our Mormon pioneers. He traveled with the Donner Party, and had they followed his lead, they would have reached California as he did. There, he became, again, a respected citizen and civic leader, both under Mexican and American governments. Here, from the book, is my account of how Rockwell described his first impression of Lilburn Boggs during the 1833 and 34 difficulties in Jackson County. Quoting from the book, "We was told he strolled around through the ruins of W.W. Phelps's printing business, stepping through scattered type and scorched press sheets like some tin-horn army officer surveying a battlefield. You know what our Jackson boys can do," he speechified to all them saints trying to sort their lives out of the mess them mobbers left, "and you must leave the country." And that was in 1833. End of quotation. The shared history of these two factual men is the basis for the assassination of Governor Boggs, but the main character is a fictional one. an imaginary agent of Pinkerton's National Detective Agency, Calvin Pogue. Engaged by Bill Boggs and the Boggs family after the governor's death in the Civil War, Pogue is attempting to determine once and for all who shot the governor 25 years earlier in Independence, Missouri. This much about the shooting is true, and here is how it's told in the book. Less than 4 feet away from where the governor sat, storm-spattered window glass exploded in a powder blast and shower of buckshot. 17 double-aught balls sprayed the room. Most blew past Boggs, barely missing Bill's 6-year-old sister, he said, as she rocked a baby sister's cradle, leaving 13 pockmarks trickling plaster dust down the wall beyond. 4 balls found their mark. 2 ripped into the left side of Boggs's head and tore through the skull and into the brain. 1 shredded the muscles of his neck and lodged in the gore. The 4th burned through the back of his neck and the roof of his mouth and was swallowed with a gout of blood as his head flopped over the chair back. Hearing the uproar from the dining room, Bill, a boy of 16 at the time, rushed into the deathly stillness and drifting powder smoke to find his father helplessly gushing lifeblood and his sisters in stunned silence. Leaving the rest of the family to deal with things as best they could, he ran into town to spread the alarm. End of quotation from the book there. Crowds soon gathered at the crime scene, and 4 of the city's finest physicians, one of them Governor Boggs's brother, attended the victim, but despite their best efforts, the doctors agreed the governor was a dead man who would not last the night. But he did survive the night and lived another 18 years. Testimony to his toughness and tenacity. When law officers arrived, the gathering crowd had trampled out in the mud any evidence the shooter might have left behind in the yard, except the gun, found by a bystander in a mud puddle near the shattered window. It was a big, heavy, German-made pistol of the pepperbox design. A 4-barreled, percussion-cap-fired muzzle loader that could be loaded with balls, buckshot, or both, or, for that matter, with roofing nails or rocks or anything else the shooter cared to ram down the barrels over a load of gunpowder. This is a pepperbox pistol of similar design, although smaller in size and caliber, and featuring 6 barrels rather than 4. This, as it happens, is the pistol that Joseph Smith employed in the gunfight at Carthage Jail before he was killed. But the gun that shot Boggs was of a heavier caliber with longer barrels and fully loaded with a large powder charge and packed with buckshot. Only 1 of the 4 barrels was fired. And that's really about it so far as the facts of the crime. No one saw the shooter. The crime was unsolved at the time and still was when Pogue was hired to ferret out the killer 25 years later. Bill Boggs had no real expectations of anything coming from identifying the shooter, but he and his family wanted the questions answered. In the psychobabble of our day, they were seeking closure. Pogue's investigations and the book begin in the company of William Boggs, the governor's son, in Sonoma, California. The agent then seeks information in the San Francisco Bay Area, and from there, he takes the Isthmus route to return to the Pinkerton office in Chicago. His inquiries next take him to Springville, Illinois, and then the Nauvoo area. He follows the trail to Independence, Missouri, in that neighborhood, then to Salt Lake City, where the story ends. Along the way, the detective interviews several people known to history and a few other folks made up to fill in the blanks. In all cases, of course, the conversations are invented, but as much as possible, the information conveyed to the agent is true to the historical record and represents the recorded thoughts or knowledge of people around the crime. Among the invented characters integral to the investigation in the story include Albert Scott Cornforth, attorney for the estate of John C. Bennett. Bennett was recently dead at the time of the investigation, but his accusations were crucial to the crime, and so his attorney provides the means for their inclusion in the investigation in the book. Owen Bradley is a clerk of the Illinois District Court and former court reporter. He was at the hearing in Springfield when the state of Missouri attempted to have Joseph Smith extradited from Illinois to stand trial in Missouri for ordering the shooting of Boggs. Another invented character is Rutherford C. Fargo, sheriff of Hancock County, Illinois, and former deputy to Sheriff Jacob Backenstalls, who tried to maintain order during the fighting around Nauvoo in the early 1840s. Fargo, though fictional, describes a real incident in Illinois law enforcement. He tells of Porter Rockwell's first documented killing, which occurred in Hancock County in 1845. And this is how it's related in the book. Fargo told of a time when Sheriff Backenstoss was driving on the Warsaw Road one fall morning and spied three horsemen and two others in a wagon. He recognized one of the riders as a decided Mormon hater, a man named Frank Worrell, who led the militia mob that killed Joseph Smith, and suspected they were up to no good. His guess must have been a good one, for the minute they saw the sheriff, they set out after him, figuring finding him alone on a country road offered a good chance to get rid of him. Backenstalls whipped up his team, but was losing ground. He topped a hill, and the road dropped down to a stream crossing. As it happened, Porter Rockwell and a companion were stopped there, dismounted and watering their horses. The sheriff reined up in a cloud of dust, told the men of his predicament, and deputized them on the spot to protect him. Now, quoting Sheriff Fargo, J.B. told me that Port pulled his rifle from its saddle scabbard and stepped into the road cool as summer lemonade. About that time, Worrell and another rider topped the rise, having left the buckboard and other rider behind in the race. Fargo says the sheriff hollered out at them and they stopped 100, maybe 150 yards away. J.B. told him to leave off, but Worrell drew his pistol. He never had a chance to fire. Porter Rockwell cut loose with his rifle and hit his target square in the belly, even at that distance. They said the shot knocked Worrell out of the saddle and tipped him head over heels off that horse's rump, and he hit the road like so many pounds of lightning-struck sheep. About that time, Worrell's wagon showed up. They tossed his body in the back, wheeled around, and drove away from Rockwell's smoking rifle like there was a pack of rabid wolves nipping at their heels. End of quotation from the book. Among the real people, the historical characters interviewed by the Pinkerton agent in the story, was Samuel Brannan, a Mormon pioneer and early California settler, and at the time a disaffected church member. He knew Rockwell and had firsthand knowledge of Boggs's life in California. Jacob Harlan, a California pioneer who traveled west with the Donner Party and Lilburn Boggs, who heard rumors about murderous Mormons pursuing the governor across the plains. Emma Smith Bitterman, widow of Joseph Smith, who knew Rockwell for many years and was in Nauvoo during the shooting and its aftermath. Joseph A. Reynolds, justice of the peace, who was sheriff in Independence, Missouri at the time of the shooting. He investigated the crime and attempted to bring Rockwell and Joseph Smith to justice. Alexander Donovan, attorney, Richmond, Missouri, who represented Rockwell in court. As a lawyer, he had represented the property claims of several Mormons in Missouri in the 1830s, and as a Missouri militia officer, was involved in the Mormon War of 1837 and 38. William Wild Bill Hickman, so-called destroying angel and a contemporary of Porter Rockwell, who had a long relationship with Rockwell and was engaged in similar work for leaders of the Mormon Church. Brigham Young, president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who employed Rockwell as a bodyguard and for other purposes. Patrick Edward Connor, former military officer and sometime employer of Porter Rockwell as a scout and guide. And Orrin Porter Rockwell himself, suspect in the assassination attempt. His long narrative is interspersed throughout the book, reconstructed from the fictional case notes of Calvin Poe, but based on facts. But back to the crimes, we look at Independence, Missouri. Following the shooting in Independence, a group of citizens offered a reward for the capture of a suspect named Tompkins, who, they said in a newspaper advertisement, surely committed the crime. Who this man was, or whether or not he was a serious suspect, or even if he existed, is somewhat of a mystery. There is little or no information I can find that law enforcement officials ever investigated or pursued him. The only people that seemed to be interested in was this citizens' committee. There was no real suspect until a storekeeper in the area recognized the found pistol as one recently stolen from his store. When he first noticed it missing, he blamed a group of slaves who had been in the store, but his investigation proved them innocent. The only person he could, without question, connect to the weapon was a man named Brown, who worked caring for horses for a local landowner. Brown was seen handling the weapon in the store, and shortly afterward it turned out missing. The next time the pistol was seen was in the mud at the crime scene. Investigations soon revealed that Brown was an alias. The man's real name, according to local residents who had known him when he lived in the area years earlier, was Porter Rockwell. Rockwell was not apprehended or questioned at the time because the day after the shooting, he fortuitously boarded a riverboat and left town, making his way to the relative safety of Nauvoo, Illinois. He immediately became the prime suspect. At about the same time in Nauvoo, church and community leader and Joseph Smith confidant, Joseph C. Bennett, fell into disfavor with the Mormon church, and his relationship with Joseph Smith was in free fall. He publicly accused Rockwell of shooting Boggs, and beyond that accused Smith of ordering the hit. And he told Lilburn Boggs so. This created pressure from Missouri on Illinois officials to arrest and extradite Smith and Rockwell, but all efforts to do so, and there were a lot of them, failed. Still, Rockwell was distressed by all this to the point that he left town to hide out in the eastern states. After several months of hard times, owing to his inability to find work, he came home. But the moment he stepped ashore in St. Louis to transfer to a boat that would take him upriver to Nauvoo, bounty hunters hanging around the landing recognized and snared Rockwell and hauled him to Independence so they could collect the sizable rewards on his head. For some 8 months, Rockwell was jailed in Independence, often in horrific conditions. He was starved down to a skeleton of his former self, regularly chained in a cold dungeon where he slept in filthy straw, and denied any semblance of his constitutional rights as a citizen or prisoner. He nearly escaped several times and did so once, but was soon captured and locked up again. On more than one occasion, he was nearly lynched by angry citizens. During all this time, he was never formally charged with any crime. A grand jury refused to indict him for the shooting, owing to a lack of evidence. But a hostile judge and unsympathetic sheriff refused to release him and kept him locked up illegally until area attorney Alexander Donovan engineered his release. Here is how I imagine Donovan might have described the situation to Pogue. And this again is quoting from the book. "I was appointed Mr. Rockwell's counsel in August. He had, at that point, been jailed since March. No charges had been filed against him in all that time. No hearing had been held. He had not been afforded any opportunity to speak for himself in court, confront his accusers, or address the evidence against him. All that, of course, flies in the face of the rights every citizen is afforded under our laws and the Constitution of our country. But Sheriff Reynolds and Judge Ryland had no intention of releasing Mr. Rockwell. They were determined to hold him regardless of legalities. They informed him that he had been indicted for escaping from jail and would be held and brought to trial on that charge. The jury saw the absurdity of the prosecution's charges, and while they found Mr. Rockwell guilty of breaking out of jail, their sentence of no less than 5 minutes in the Jackson County Jail revealed their true opinion." That's the end of that reading from the book. Rockwell was finally released and dodged angry Missouri citizens as he made his way cross-country and arrived in Nauvoo in time to crash Joseph Smith's Christmas party at the Mansion House. Believed to be a vermin-infested drunken tramp, he was almost tossed out on his ear, but Joseph finally recognized him. They say the prophet then pronounced a legendary blessing on the unshaven, unshorn Rockwell, promising that so long as he remained loyal to the church and did not cut his hair or beard, no bullet or blade could harm him. Within a few years, both Boggs and Rockwell migrated west, and forever after, they made it a point to keep their distance. Both men were wary, each fearful the other wanted him dead and would take measures to see it done. but there is no record of any such thing ever happening. For several months, the two enemies lived within 150 miles of each other, Boggs at home in Sonoma, and Rockwell running pack trains out of Sacramento to supply whiskey to his saloons in the Sierra gold fields. But they never crossed paths again, and both eventually died of more or less natural causes, Boggs in 1860 and Rockwell in 1878. Fictional Pinkerton agent Calvin Pogue's investigation into the shooting included the aforementioned interviews with people with knowledge of the incident, as well as extensive research in newspaper files and the examination of court records. He visited the scene of the crime with the original investigating officer, and eventually spent several hours in the company of Porter Rockwell listening to a prolonged monologue concerning the shooting, the man's history in Missouri, and many other aspects of his life and times. The detective reaches his own conclusions about the case, but informs Bill Boggs that there never was, is not now, and most likely never would be enough evidence to convict Rockwell in a court of law. But he finds the circumstantial and hearsay evidence damning, and that, along with there being no other reasonable explanation for the assassination attempt, persuades him that Rockwell was, in fact, the shooter. Here is a summary of the detective's reasoning. Rockwell was known to be in the Independence area at the time, which must be viewed as suspicious given the circumstances and his personal history in the area. Before the gun used in the crime was discovered stolen from a store near Independence, Rockwell was the last person known to have handled it. His rapid departure from Independence following the shooting was too opportune to be coincidental. The only other named suspect attracted little interest and was soon forgotten. And, of course, there's the fact that Rockwell and every other Mormon had an obvious motive to want Boggs removed. And Rockwell's fleeing Nauvoo and living on the lam was suspicious and otherwise inexplicable. John C. Bennett's accusations that Rockwell shot Boggs under orders from Joseph Smith, while not altogether reliable, did not draw an unequivocal denial of guilt from Rockwell. He did not deny shooting the governor, only that Smith ordered it. Other reports indicate he never denied committing the crime, he only prevaricated. Bennett is a notorious figure in Mormon history, but his reputation in history is not as sullied as Mormon accounts might lead one to believe. Here is how, in the book, an imaginary attorney for his estate described him in a letter to Pogue. The presentation is fictional, but the information is true. Quoting from the letter. It is also common knowledge that his conduct and character have been called into question by some, particularly the Mormons. We can only say that in all our relationships with Mr. Bennett, his integrity was of the highest order. This, of course, does not speak to his prior behavior, but we find it unlikely that the leopard, so to speak, could change his spots. During his residence in nearby Polk City, Mr. Bennett earned the respect and admiration of his neighbors. He practiced medicine and was a sought-after surgeon, even here in the city, because of his early adoption of the anesthetic chloroform. He also made many strides in the field of gynecology. Horticulture and animal husbandry were among his many hobbies, and his accomplishments in those areas may be likened to those of professional agriculturalists. His vegetable breeding experiments with tomatoes led to improved varieties. Professional journals published his papers on the breeding of chickens, and Mr. Bennett, in fact, developed several new breeds of fowl. End of that fictional letter, but based on fact. And back to the Pinkerton agent's evidence against Rockwell. Rockwell's reputation for resorting to violence in the years after the crime lends credence to the idea that he was a willing killer. The number of people he killed, of course, varies, but most accounts put it probably at about 24. General Patrick Edward Connor claimed Rockwell admitted the shooting during one of their drinking bouts. Connor was widely known as honest and forthright, even among the Mormons, who both hated and admired him. Based on reported accounts of Rockwell's confession to Connor, here's how I imagine Connor might have related the incident. Pogue wondered if there was any truth to reports that Rockwell committed murder and other atrocities on order from this church leader. Sure there was. He told me so himself. Do you think he should answer for it? Connor considered the question for a moment. I'm a military man, Mr. Pogue. I guess the best answer I can give is that Porter is a good soldier, loyal, trusted. He was only following orders. Did he ever talk about his days in Missouri, in particular the shooting of Governor Boggs there? He did. I shot through the window, said he during our merrymaking one time, and I thought I had killed him, but I had only wounded him. I was sorry that I had not killed the son of a bitch. That's how he put it. Incidentally, that profanity which Connor was said to have uttered was edited out of the book along with all the other cuss words, so you won't find that in there. Anyway, the evidence is flimsy, for sure, and no single fact is damning, but taken together they can be considered convincing. It is understandable that Calvin Pogue, along with Bill Boggs and thousands of other reasonable people down through the years, thought and think Porter Rockwell guilty. Then again, maybe he's not. In any case, we all know that guilt, in the legal sense, courtroom guilt, is not necessarily related to whether or not a person actually committed the crime. O.J. Simpson and Casey Anthony come to mind. So, perhaps fiction is every bit as good a way to get at the truth of the crime as the legal system or any other method. The investigation and the evidence are treated in more detail in the assassination of Governor Boggs. You can purchase a copy in the bookstore down there from Benchmark Books. I won't give away the ending, but I will say that the last word is Porter Rockwell's. Maybe. Thank you. Are there any questions? Sir?
So, yeah, my understanding was that Connor did say, son of a bitch.
He did. All the account that recorded that was the word he used.
And when's it going to be made into a movie?
Gosh, you know, I don't know. Probably never, truth be told. I do have it. It's interesting. I have a friend who lives here in Ogden. He was an old college roommate and rodeo buddy of mine from way back when. He was raised Mormon, sort of, but he has never been active in the church in all the years I know him and for several years before that. But he read the book and also read my book on the Bear River Massacre and stuffed them both in an envelope with a letter and sent it off to Clint Eastwood. So, of course, when it got there, I'm sure it ended up right in the trash can. But, you know, as far as any movie coming of it, I doubt it. Sir?
I might have missed some of your description at the beginning of the presentation, but as you sort of organized the material, what you knew, what you didn't know, uh-huh. and you developed figures that would be conduits for explaining events that you otherwise knew probably had happened. Uh-huh. How did you map out that process? What's the first thing you did when you got the idea? And what kind of lists did you make?
Well, it was really almost took care of itself, really. Jacob Backenstos was the sheriff of Hancock County, and all Frank Worrell and all of his Mormon-hating buddies thought that Backenstos was in bed with the Mormons. He thought he gave the Mormons, cut them too much slack and was on their side way too often. But he had died before the period that this book is set, which is 25 years after the crime. And he went off to Oregon and committed suicide. And so he wasn't available. I couldn't talk to him, so I thought, well, how his story is important because it's the first recorded killing that Rockwell committed. So I thought, well, you know, he's a sheriff. He's probably got a deputy. So I came up with this character named Rutherford C. Fargo, which is a little story in itself. I correspond with a group of Western writers who mostly write shoot 'em up cowboy novels. And for several years now, every once in a while, we use the name Ford Fargo for a minor character in all these books. So if you go on Google Books and Google Ford Fargo several things will pop up, which is neither here nor there. But Bennett had died, and he was pivotal in all of this. Of course, his accusations led to Missouri trying to extradite him from Missouri, and he Rockwell was arrested, and Joseph Smith was arrested. Of course, they were always turned loose by the courts in Nauvoo, and then the court later in Springfield decided that this is stupid for the state of Missouri to try to have us extradite Joseph Smith and Rockwell for a crime that wasn't committed in Illinois. You know, they've committed no crime here, so how can we arrest them? And their evidence was pretty flimsy anyway. So I needed that to come out, so I invented Owen Bradley, who was theoretically a court reporter at the time of the trial and is now the clerk of the district court, and he helps Pogue find all the records in the book. And Pogue tells about, you know, the attorney, I think it was Pope, or maybe he was the judge, I don't recall, but made an interesting little speech. This judge always surrounded himself with pretty ladies on the bench, and one of them at this trial, they believe, was Mary Lincoln. But anyway, this attorney gets up and he says, in the presence of royalty, surrounded by angels, and in the presence of the apostles of the Lord, you know, and it's an interesting little speech that I lifted from the court records and used in the book. Who else was fictional? Let me try to think. But that's kind of the process I used, you know. I mean, someone...
So you need to convey information.
Yeah.
You put somebody there at a time where that could be conveyed. And the information is already there.
Yeah, the information is accurate.
Speak it or present it.
Yeah. Well, accurate. John C. Bennett's information is always suspect. I mean, nobody knows. But he was dead, and so I invented it just recently. Pogue actually wrote a letter to the address he could find for Bennett and heard back from the attorneys with this letter that they wrote. And they sent him a copy of the book that Bennett had written. So,
it's a fictional character, but it sounds like nonfiction.
Yeah, based on actual information, yeah.
You mentioned the first documented murder was Morrell. So you suspect there were previous murders?
You know, there may have been. There are stories of Joseph Smith and Porter Rockwell drowning an old woman in Nauvoo who was giving them trouble. Not very well documented, or not documented at all. And there are other stories, but there's really not a lot of evidence.
There was a story about a black man that was murdered in Ohio, in central Ohio, that may have been related to... Did you ever come across that?
Not familiar with that. I know there was a black man that was murdered here in Utah, and they're pretty sure that Rockwell was involved in that. He was caught sleeping with a white woman, and he took off. They told him to leave town, and then immediately chased him down and emasculated him and killed him.
Emasculation was a punishment for was that typical in the Old West during that time?
You know, they committed all kinds of atrocities against black people. I know they did that again. A man was accused or caught of sleeping with his mother, and they drove them out, and they caught them in Payson in a little dugout hut where they were hiding, killed them both. They emasculated him, then killed them both and just pulled the little dugout down on him and set it afire, as I recall.
Was Rockwell familiar with a fellow by the name of Black Pete, who was in Kirtland?
You know, I don't know, but I doubt it, because Rockwell didn't go to Kirtland. He was with the first bunch of Mormons that went to Independence. So he didn't go to Kirtland. To my knowledge, he never even visited there, but that could be wrong. I should mention that most of the information about Rockwell, there are two biographies, one of which is quite old and pretty histrionic, and it's not too accurate. But Harold Schindler's biography remains the most accurate and well documented biography of Rockwell. And I've read others, and there's a little pamphlet by a guy named Nicholas Van Alphen, and there are a whole bunch of research papers and that sort of thing stuck in archives that I've buried, but Schindler's really the best source.
So is it true that Rockwell's home was where Utah State Prison sits at the point of the mountain?
Well, he had several homes over the years. He had a place in downtown Salt Lake, and he had a stable, Colorado Stables, and he had a room there where he stayed a lot. He had a ranch out in the West Desert on Government Creek that's still there. I've not visited it, but I know a guy who knows that country really well. He says if you just take the Pony Express Road out from Vernon, and he can tell you how to find it. It's pretty easy to find if you know which road it is. It's still out there. And he had a place further down in, not sure it was in Juab County or Southern Twilla County. I think it was Juab County. But he did have a hotel and a bar at Point of the Mountain. It was called the Hot Springs Hotel and Brewery.
The hot springs are still there.
Yeah, and there's a monument somewhere that talks about that Rockwell was here. But at the time he owned that, he lived most of the time in Lehigh. He had a house in Lehigh. Uh-huh. And traveling home from the hotel to Lehigh one night led to another documented killing. That's a pretty good story, but there are lots of good stories about Rockwell. Some of them are, you know, pretty much surely untrue, but a lot of them are. You know, he really is forgotten for the most part to Western history, and Mormon history we kind of turn a blind eye to him a little bit. But in those days, he was as well known and feared throughout the West, all the way from the Mississippi River to the California coast. He was well known, and people feared him. He was a notorious gunman, and so, you know, that's something
he
we don't.
The part.
He did.
What was his relationship with Joseph Smith that made them think that?
He was. He lived in the same part of New York that Joseph Smith did. He was about 10 years younger than Smith. And, you know, Joseph Smith had injured his leg and had that infection, and so he kind of walked with a limp. Well, Rockwell, as a little boy, also had an injury, I think, to his hip. I don't recall that for sure. So he also walked with a little limp and kind of left both of them unsuited to hard labor in the fields and whatnot. So he was very much attracted to Smith. And he really admired him. You know, he just looked up to him. Smith was kind of a hero. And in fact, Rockwell was one of the first people. He was at the meeting in 1830 when the church was formally organized, one of the first people baptized into the church. And when he died, he had been a Mormon longer than anybody else alive because he had been baptized so early on. And when Joseph Smith died, he threw in his lot with Brigham Young and was every bit as loyal to Brigham Young as he had been to Joseph Smith.
Yeah, many years ago, I studied with T.A. Gerlein at the Institute of Religion at the U of U. He was in charge of Nauvoo Restoration, and I spent time with him there. He was talking to me about an incident, and I don't know where the source is, but he told me about how one time Joseph was headed back on a gallop from Quincy, and there were guys after him. And he came around a corner just south of Nauvoo, and Porter Rockwell stepped out of the bushes and said, told Joseph, keep going, I'll stop him. And as these guys came around the bend, he shot a couple of them out of the saddle, and they turned around and went back to Quincy. Have you ever heard of that story?
You know, it doesn't ring a bell specifically, but there are several stories like that, and it very well could be true. Well,
Dr. Lyon was an expert on Nauvoo era.
It probably,
I don't know where he got it. It should be fun to find again.
It could be. And, you know, I could go back through the sources and see if it was there. I'm fairly well read on Rockwell, but, you know, a lot of details escape me, and here for the last couple of years I really concentrated on stuff related
to Boggs.
So there are a lot of things that happened that that I don't know, that I don't remember.
Now, I apologize because I was called out a little bit, and you may have covered it, but it's alleged, and I don't remember where I read it, but that Porter Rockwell complained that he shouldn't have shot through the glass because the glass deflected the bullet when he was shooting at Governor Boggs. Now, did you
that's one of the stories you heard, and I think that is reported in the book by, I can't think of their name, but that is one story, and it could have been, but he was only 4 feet away.
Do you give it any credibility?
Well, you know, a lot of people say that one of the biggest excuses that mostly Mormons make for the fact that Porter Rockwell couldn't possibly have done this, most of those excuses are wishful thinking, but one of the most often quoted is that if Rockwell had shot at Boggs, Boggs would be dead. But he hit him.
4 times.
You know, I mean, this was another excuse they make is that he wouldn't have used buckshot, he would have used a ball.
Yeah.
But this is double up buckshot we're talking about. These balls are 32 caliber, between 30 and 32 caliber. They're not, you know, you line up three of them and it makes an inch. And he had them packed in there, and it was not unusual at the time to do that. And for years, you know, Wyatt Earp went to the gunfight at the OK Corral with a shotgun loaded with buckshot.
Yeah.
And in the Civil War even, it was not unusual for them to load what they called buck and ball. They would put a ball of the caliber of the rifle and then two or three balls of buckshot down on top of it.
Yeah.
And the accuracy with that method was, I don't remember the exact figure, but it was much greater than if they just used the ball. So the excuse that buckshot wouldn't have been used is just nonsense.
So you mentioned about Jolda's pistol. That was the pistol that you showed. Did he only fire it once down the hall, or was...
No, I think he emptied all six barrels.
So three of them misfired, though.
Oh, did they?
Yeah,
okay.
But he cranked it all the way around.
Yeah.
As I understand, there were some who were shot that later died from their wounds. But
that could be.
The pistol, I don't know if you mentioned that, the picture you have, I think it's on display in the Church History Museum.
Right, yeah, now. That's where that picture came from.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, it was, you know, I mean, it was definitely murder and definitely mobbers, but it started out as a gunfight.
You know,
Smith was, yeah. I mean, he had a gun and he was shooting back.
So the Porter's gun, though, could have fired another 4 or 5 times.
Three more. It had
three
four barrels. The thought was that he had loaded it so heavy, which is another excuse people use. He would have known how to load it well. You know, those muzzle loaders, they'd put in whatever they thought they could get away with. The thinking is that the sheriff at the time thought that when he shot it, the recoil was so great that it knocked it out, you know, that it flew out of his hand and into the mud. And rather than try to find it, he just took off.
So, yeah, that would explain why he didn't fire a second time.
Yeah, that's the reason why, because the gun ended up in the mud.
Wow.
But, you know, 4 30 caliber balls in your head is pretty
that's
lethal. And the two balls that were in his brain stayed there for the rest of his life.
You would walk away from that thinking he was dead.
Yeah, the doctors did. Four doctors all said he ain't going to make it.
Wow.
And his brother, his son said that he was never really the same after that. I mean, he recovered, obviously, but his brother said that he was actually smarter after losing a big chunk of his brain than he had been before. And he swallowed one, and I don't know what, you know, it was probably evacuated.
Yeah.
And the other they dug out of the muscles in his neck.
Wow. I mean, I've heard this story about, like, with Porter Rockwell before, just like at the beginning how you said, like, some of his killings were, like, some were crimes, were questionable, or something that he should have done. Like, what are some of the examples of the different ones?
Of which, the illegal ones?
Yeah.
The murders? Well, the biggest one, and the one he was on trial for, the day he died.
Where at?
He in Salt Lake City. He died in his stable. He went to a play, went to a saloon, drank a little, came back to his stable where he had a little room where he slept, and got sick in the night, and the hostler came in, and, you know, Rockwell was up puking, and he sat up on his bed and put on his boots, keeled over, and didn't die instantly. I mean, they brought doctors in. They don't really know why he died. But he was on trial for the murder of some people known as the Aiken Party. And they had showed up in Utah in 1857. Now, this trial is taking place in 1878, or would. Because it took that long for the government to wrest control of the courts away from people and find evidence. But this group of people came in from California. There were two brothers named Aiken and another one they called Honesty John and two or three others that came to town knowing that the U.S. Army was coming during the Utah War in 1857, well, they were going to come and gamble. They were gamblers. They were going to come and fleece the soldiers of all their money. And they were arrested. They came in on the northern route from California, and they were arrested up in either Ogden or Brigham City. I don't recall exactly which. They took them down to Salt Lake, and Brigham Young is suspicious because he knows the army's coming, and as far as he knows, these people are spies. I mean, they're rich, they're well-dressed, they've got all these fancy saddles and all this gambling stuff. So he's suspicious, thinks, well, maybe they're just hanging around here so they can go tell the army what we're up to. So he kept them in confinement. Excuse me, a couple of them he turned loose to wander at will, but eventually told them they had to leave and suggested that they take the southern road to California. And so they passed through Salt Creek or Nephi, got down to the Sevier River and set up camp one night. And they were being escorted by Porter Rockwell and I think, his name escapes me. He was another well-known ruffian at the time. So they're sitting around the fire in the evening, and when they had stopped in Nephi, apparently Rockwell had recruited some helpers. They came out, snuck through the bushes up to the fire, and Rockwell and his partner and these other people lit into them, shot some of them, beat them over the head with they said pipes. I don't know what they would have been. They threw two of them in the river, one of which was dead. The other one they thought was dead. He'd been shot in the back. But he got in the river and the water revived him and he floated downstream a ways and crawled out. One of them had been hit in the head and knocked it down and out. But in all the melee, he snuck away. Two of them made it back to Nephi and got a room at a house there. And there was a young boy living in the house who saw them. They put them in bed and tended them, and Rockwell, they came back. And they stayed at the house, and this kid heard them making plans of what they were going to do next. So in a few days, they loaded these two guys, Aiken and the other guy, in a wagon or a buggy to take them back to Salt Lake. They got a little ways north of Nephi at a place called Willow Springs, which might be Burston Ponds now, I'm not sure. But there was a little sheep herder shack there, and there was a spring there where along the road where people stopped to water their horses, and they stopped to water the horses. The two guys got out of the wagon to stretch their legs, and shotgun barrels and probably a rifle came out the door and gunned them down right there, and they tossed them in the water. And they, as I said, Rockwell was later arrested for that crime and was on trial. There were two young men who escaped jail and were hiding out up in Emigration Canyon. He went up there with a sheriff to catch them. They tracked them down and they came back dead. They were unarmed. They were young boys, you know, 16, 17 years old. And the story was that Rockwell hauled them out of there in a wagon and dumped them in their mother's dooryard. Told him if she had done her job, he wouldn't have had to have done his. So those two killings were, you know, probably didn't have to occur. But he also killed a lot of outlaws that needed killing. And to his way of thinking, he never killed anybody that didn't need it. You know, that was a common thought in the Old West, that never killed anybody that didn't need killing. He was right in there with that.
I have an author and editor question. You said the son of a bitch and other cuss words were edited out of your manuscript.
Uh-huh.
I guess in the 21st century, I'm wondering why.
Well, it was published by Cedar Fort, which is not affiliated with the church, but publishes mostly Mormon books.
Okay.
And they said they like all their stuff to be squeaky clean. And there weren't any bad cuss words. I mean, I quoted Brigham Young saying we're going to send them to hell across lots. I mean, that's a direct quote, and they took that out.
They took it out.
You know, damn, hell, things like that is really all that was in there. But they chose to sanitize it, which, you know, all things considered, didn't make that much difference. It lost some of the spice.
I had one Rockwell question. the photo you had plus something you had mentioned that Joseph Smith told him if he never cut his hair, he would be protected. I had always heard that later in life, he did have his hair cut to give to a widow, I believe it was.
Yeah, it was Don Carlos Smith's widow. And she had typhoid in California and had lost her hair, so he hacked off a bunch of his hair to give to her to make a wig. Some people say that's when he went off the... You know, they say after that he started drinking too much because he was a big-time drinker. He was a party boy. You know? Huh. And they blame that on that. Now, whether that's true, nobody knows.
Is there kind of a theme with Rockwell and what happened there with the Napa Boys and the Mountain Meadow experience? Mm. Is that a...
Well, you know, it all happened at about the same time when everybody in Utah's scared and they're very hostile. And, you know, George Albert Smith and Jedediah Grant had been stirring the pot, and even Brigham Young, you know, to an extent. You know, we've got to be careful. If anybody comes in here without permission, we've got to get rid of them, you know. So they were very paranoid. So, yeah, it's all tied into that same paranoia that was... That was prevalent at the time.
Other questions?
Looks like we've got about 2 minutes.
Or any other afterthoughts that have come to you while the questions have been going on?
You know, I mentioned Connor's, that he confessed to Connor, and that was fairly well documented. But it's not the only one. William Law said many years later that Joseph Smith told him that he told Rockwell to kill Bob. But that was so long after the fact that it isn't given a lot of credence. And one of the... Oh, what's their name? They were one of the witnesses to the Book of Mormon.
There are two. Calvary. Page.
No. Anyway, they claimed that Joseph Smith told them that Rockwell shot Boggs, but there's not a lot of proof for that either. I just heard from Will Bagley not too long ago that there are some people in the Taylor family, from John down through Samuel, that claim firsthand knowledge of sitting on the porch with Porter Rockwell and having him boasting about doing it. Now, I only learned that recently, and I don't know what the documentation is.
In terms of Joseph Smith telling him all Joseph Smith could say would be, you know, he would be better off dead. And that would be enough.
Yeah. You know, most of the evidence, it's like, you know, our politicians nowadays. They say, well, there's no direct link between all this money we gave this politician and getting this contract. You can't find any record. Well, you know, a wink and a nod and a hint, that's all it takes. You know.
I think it's been a couple of years since I've read Schindler's book, but didn't he say, like, once Porter Rockwell returned after Boggs was shot, that Joseph Smith had, like, a team of horses in a wagon for him?
Was part of Bennett's accusation, that Smith had given him $500 and a fancy wagon and team of horses as a reward. And that's really what, that led to a confrontation between Rockwell and Bennett, where Rockwell went to his house and burst in, and Bennett was there meeting with some others, and he got him alone, and he said, if you ever, you know, that's not true, if you ever accuse Joseph Smith of telling me to kill Boggs, you know, you're done.
So was that gift a documented thing, or was that just an accusation?
No, it was documented. He was seen around Nauvoo by many people with his new wagon, his team of horses, but again, you know, nobody wrote in the church records that Joseph Smith gave this gift to Porter Rockwell because he shot Governor Box.
Sure.
It just isn't there.
We have time for one more question.
That's the easiest one so far.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for being here. And, you know, I wouldn't be a writer if I didn't encourage you to run right down to the book room and buy several copies. Buy them for your friends, your neighbors.
Also, if you have not picked up an evaluation form for the symposium as a whole, it would be really helpful to get feedback from people. I'll just leave these up here. And thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.